are listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
Next to him, we've got Bobby Sommerfeld.
Hello, Mike.
That's just trouble right there.
Yeah.
Both those guys together.
Oh, my God.
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
And Scott's not with us today due to a email malfunction.
That is true.
But I'd like to welcome everybody to the Audio Nowcast. And the Audio Nowcast is a place where we talk about the audio industry. We talk about music, post-productions, really, you know, anything that has to do with making sounds. Today we're going to be talking about a couple different things. First, right off the bat, I want to tell you guys that this is show number 38.
Ooh.
Wow.
That's special.
That is
38.
Amazing.
I never believed we'd have the stamina.
I never believed we could count that high.
And I will mention that Rob's been to every single podcast.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, indeed.
I have got to get a life.
I just think that's amazing.
Even more than you, Mike. And you run it.
Yeah, one more, right?
One more. Yeah, I've only been to 37.
That's amazing. Wow.
But yes, he has done 38 shows.
He is our god.
He is.
Our leader.
He's Cal Ripken, man. And the reason why I bring that up is I went to a podcast convention this past weekend that they had over at Ontario. And it was really kind of cool to be there.
Did they know about us?
Believe it or not, a couple people actually had heard about us.
Wow.
And it was really neat when you're talking to these people that are starting a podcast. And it's like, how many shows have you done? Four? Uh-huh. 12? Two?
And you were just walking around with, like, strutting.
Yeah,
37.
You didn't have a t-shirt made, did you?
No, it was really a proud moment about what we've done here and the feedback and the community, really, that we've built with the Audio Nowcast.
It's like we cry,
it must be doing good. Because Mike, no one can see him, of course, but well, we can, of course, but he's wearing the expensive Bose noise-canceling headphones.
Yes,
that's
here.
Right.
Well, it's only because the studio we're in right now is air-conditioning.
Anyhow, that was kind of... Wow, it's going to be a long evening.
Yes. Now, we have Sommerfeld amongst us, so we do have
I've been here for about five podcasts.
No, Bobby, you've been good lately. I haven't even been giving you a hard time.
Thank you.
Hey, before we get into some of the stuff we're going to be talking about, I wanted to mention a few things from a couple listeners. And one is from a really good listener in New Jersey. His name is Mark Ruffino. And he wrote in and he was talking about, remember when we were talking about the modded microphones and the cheap Chinese microphones and the fact that we listened to a bunch of them and they sounded like crap?
Oh, the little OEM microphones?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, not spectacular.
He was just talking about how a lot of those microphones actually have a lot of ways that you can mod them. And that got me thinking about, you know, maybe doing a show sometime on modded microphones and get a little technical about how to hot rod, not just microphones, but some of your gear. And I think somewhere down the line, we'll talk a little bit about that. But Bobby, you were, you know, those two mics that I
said sold them, yeah.
You said you
bought a 57.
You would have done well to buy a 57 if they were the ones I heard.
But you were saying that you did a little tweak and you got them to sound a little bit better.
Well, actually, it was more of a repair thing than a tweak.
Throw them against the wall.
I just start off by dropping them. And they always sound much better. Get rid of that low end. You didn't need them. Overrated. No, there were two ribbon microphones, and they're not very great, of course. But they have a great character. They've got a usable character. Of course, as I said, not for your best brass sound or something, but they were cool. But the one did have a little bit of a hum, and it was because that was a little grounding, you know, XLR wasn't grounding to the chassis, so when you touched it, it stopped humming, and when you let go of it, it would hum, and that's because, you know, the shield wasn't, from the mic cable, wasn't connecting to the metal case, and obviously it was connected out on the inside of the XLR, and that wasn't really a mod, that was just how it should have been built in the first place.
Yeah, because Mark in his email, he was talking about some of those Chinese microphones, especially the ribbon ones, how they have a lot of windscreening on them, like five layers of windscreen.
You've got to take a good chunk of those off.
Yeah, he said once you get in there and you take them, take a lot of those off, that it just opens up the microphones.
Absolutely.
But don't they do that just to protect the ribbon itself?
They do, yes. Yeah. Because normally people don't realize that ribbon microphones are more susceptible to wind blasts than other microphones.
Right. Yeah.
So you can't go and put it in front of a kick drum. But if you do with these microphones, you won't take out the ribbon. Because, you know, like if you go like that on a ribbon microphone, there's a chance you're going to stretch it and ruin the crinkle factor of it.
That's interesting. Because I do know they use ribbon microphones a lot of times for like trumpets and brass and things of that nature.
Because the slew rate's a lot slower and they're more round sounding. They're great for mutes and trumpets. They're great for a lot of things.
I will say this. A few years ago, you know, ribbon mics have been around for a really long time. But a few years ago, we started hearing about the Royer. Right. Ribbon mics, and all of a sudden all the brass players are using them. And I've never seen a model of a microphone sweep through an industry like that thing did.
True.
Yeah, well, it was the first ribbon mic you could actually pump some level into. So you can put it right on a guitar cabinet. And a lot of things where the character of the mic would be great, but you would blow it up. Because like Bobby was saying, it's just a piece of foil. It's like a really thin piece of aluminum foil hanging. So any air, and you distort it or blow it up, and it's gone. So obviously, the ones you've got, they haven't actually strengthened the ribbon, and they've just put a bunch of windscreening on it to kind of make up for it, because now people expect to be able to put them in front of loud things. But to make a ribbon that can hold up is expensive, and that's why the Royers aren't cheap.
Right.
But it's amazing how the Royers just took over. I mean,
yeah, people rediscovered ribbon mics.
I don't know if a ribbon mic would be your first mic that you'd want to get, but if you definitely want to build up your arsenal, you should look into picking up a ribbon mic just to give you a little different flavor.
If you're a trumpet player, it'd be the first mic you want.
And it does things because of the construction physically that other mics can't do. Nothing rejects better from the sides. Nothing. Because physically, it's like looking at a credit card. When you look at it from the side, it doesn't exist, and that's the way the mic works.
Wow.
So
that's great.
And you know what, Bobby, it probably is worth repeating. You had an amazing tip about storing ribbon mics that I didn't know about.
Right.
Why don't you bring back that golden oldie?
Oh, very good. Well, you see, a ribbon mic, because of the physics of it, the actual diaphragm is just like a chunk, as Andrew said, a crinkly bit of tin foil, let's say.
Right.
And if you rest it and leave it in for long periods of time laying flat,
right,
it starts to sag. And it starts to, like a bowed piece of cardboard, it would start to sag in the middle. So you get a permanent sag in the thing. So you should try to either turn it over if you're going to keep it for a long time, or better still, stand it up vertically. And also, just by the way, for everybody using microphones, especially condenser mics that get slightly warm or tubes that get slightly warm, don't store them when they're hot. Don't put them away hot. Let them cool down in room without air conditioning, preferably. Let them come down to natural temperature. And all microphones should be stored, mine all are, with silica gel, the stuff that you have for cameras, in the case. So if there's any stuff going on, it doesn't start to corrode up the microphones unnecessarily, especially the diaphragms. Because you'll notice, like, when you're cutting a rock singer or somebody that's belting the hell out of a microphone, you're going to pop it. You've got to pop cover on to stop direct wind noise, but you want to keep it as open as possible so you get as much air and stuff.
Right.
If the person's really belting, you'll find that the beginning of the session sounds a lot different than 2 hours into the session.
The moisture totally changes the microphone.
And because it's a capacitor microphone, condenser is another term for capacitor, which is it's like an electrical condenser. So it's like a battery. Let's look at it like that, with a very thin diaphragm. If you breathe on it, you're actually changing the impedance or the resistance of that diaphragm. So you're changing the electrical output of it. So it's going to change its frequency response and also its volume output. So you get a guy belting away, make sure you're in record and get it the first couple of takes, and then go, okay, well.
Oh, for these nuggets from Summerfield, we need to be paid. We should be cash involved.
Also, it's a good thing to keep track of for people who perform live.
Because,
like, I just mixed a live concert for somebody, and the vocal sounded amazing for about the first 6 songs. And by the end of the show, there was no top end. There was absolutely nothing above 3K.
Wow.
And with the Chili Peppers, Anthony will go through 3 or 4 mics.
Wow.
He'll hear in his ears that it's starting to go dead, and he just takes it out. And it dries out for the next day. It's not like the microphone's got a problem, but it's literally just getting wet, there's no top end.
And you answered my question. I was going to ask you, you unplugged it, so it's wired, but the same applies to wireless, especially for live performance. When you have, you know, you've got a Nady pack or a wireless microphone, you've got a transmitter in there,
right,
which along with other things, the diaphragm's getting damp from the guy shouting into it or you know, whoever, and also the battery's going down, so everything starts going, treble goes and volume's like...
Wow, there's some nuggets there.
Yeah. All right.
Well, there you go.
All right, well,
well, real useful. No one's ever going to use that.
No, that's
no one
good.
Sings a song anymore anyway. It's like, they have a fart and put autotune on it. It's done.
All right. Well, I just wanted to mention that from the listeners' email. And if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
I got a question. Actually, somebody asked me when I told them about this. They don't listen to the podcast, but they will. Peter, his name is. He asked about drum kit microphones that you buy as a kit set.
Oh, yeah.
He said, what do you think of those, the Sennheisers and whatever? And I mean, I have my opinion, of course, but I don't know what you guys think of them, but they're pretty good for the bang for buck.
I think the bang for the buck, they're pretty good. If you were going to start out with just a cheap, inexpensive way to get into some microphones for drum kits, especially drums, because they take so many mics to really do a good micing job. I know a couple different, the AKG packages is pretty good.
AKG package, I think, is what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
I said,
you ever use the package?
Haven't. No, don't know.
It's because he can use the real things.
they're
I'm
good.
Getting in trouble just for sitting here. No,
it's better than not sitting here, I'll tell you.
Okay, well, I wanted to move on. This past week, I've spent a lot of time in the hospital for some family emergency that we had, and I actually had to do some work there, and I brought my laptop with a little Pro Tools mini setup, and I was sitting there in the waiting room doing some mixing and editing, and it got me thinking about another example of just working in a really bizarre, weird environment. And I was thinking, I bet some of you guys have done some work in some really bizarre places, and anybody have any stories about, comping that vocal in the hotel room on your road system or writing that song in the bathroom at the park? Wait, no.
it comes to mind that, when you're recording, sometimes you're always looking for the most emotional performance. And sometimes when you're just in the studio doing it the normal way, it all gets a bit clinical. And I remember working on Robbie Robertson's first solo album with Daniel Lemoyne. And they were cutting one of my songs that I'd written with Robbie over and over again in the normal way in the Village recorder. And it just didn't have quite that magic. So, they went up into the loft of the Village and brought all the microphones up there. And in fact, talking about microphones on drums, Lanmore was just using two mics on the whole drum kit, which sounded amazing. It was just how he placed them. And, and Manu Cachet was playing the drums and it was very percussive, but when we put more mics on, it wasn't quite as vibey. But, I remember it over 2 days. They kept on recording this song in different areas of the Village that wasn't the studio. And they eventually did get the take they wanted when they weren't thinking of being in a studio. And I remember listening to the first takes, which were technically right, but the one they did in the loft in this room, the vibe was very special. Something happened to the players. They just, let go more. And it was a different spirit.
Out of interest, you said that they used two mics on the drum kit.
Yeah.
Both times or the second time only?
I'm not sure, Bobby. I just remember thinking that the performance is on a song called Fallen Angel, and Manu played some amazing drums on it. And it's one of my favorite recordings of songs I've ever written. And because Manu played in such a percussive way and such a kind of reggae kind of, because he was a percussion player, these two mics really picked up the bass element of it. Yeah, and you could really feel that there wasn't a separation. And I do remember very clearly that when Bob Clearmountain came to mix the song, it was like, there was a little bit of debating about, I've just got, two tracks for the drums. And it was like, I know Daniel Lemoyne was very much like saying, that's what it is. That's the way it was done. We hear the room. We hear the performance. We hear the
colour,
yeah, and
commitment. I remember that.
Yeah, commitment, and yeah, very much like the early Beatles records. And so, and that's one of my favourite drum tracks. You hear the little cymbals being touched, and you feel the kick in the room. And something about that really made me think as well. When I did recording, even at home, I'll tend to think like maybe sometimes less miking. Because back to your question, Mike, it was that was a different kind of recording, and they had to get all the tie lines into rooms they hadn't used before. The bass player was out in the front foyer, and his amp was stuck against the toilet wall and everything. But it had happened, and the performance was great, I think, because it also loosened the players up to think we're doing something that is a little different, I'm sure Andrew has many stories.
Well,
like that,
first of all, that's one of my favorite tracks ever.
Oh,
I love
thank
that
you.
Song, and I love that version of the song. It's amazing.
Thank
so,
you.
Anyone who hasn't heard it should hear that. Anyway.
It was worth my drive out.
it's incredible.
Why don't you tell what that track is one more time for people out there?
Fallen Angel from Robbie Robertson's first solo album. He did lots and lots of collaborations on that record. So there was a track with U2 that got quite a bit of airplay.
Testimony.
Yeah. But it's a good album, but that, to me, is the standout track and always
has. Thank you. Peter Gabriel sang the chorus, which was a big buzz for me because they went over to Real World and he emulated what I'd done on the demo. And that's where I met Bill Dylan, the guitarist that was, you know, playing with Lamoine and Robbie Robertson, and he stayed with me for my next two albums. So it was a very special recording period. It was very...
What year was that?
Oh, God, now you've got 26. Me here.
26.
You know, it was something like the...
88.
Yeah, 89, 90, probably the end of the 80s, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, but it was his long time writing, that album. It was like 2 years of writing, and I ended up with two songs, Hell's Half Acre, which was... Robbie writes extraordinary lyrics about an Indian native going to Vietnam, and Fallen Angel was about Richard Manuel. And I'd brought him the demo of it just with the melodies and just done phonetic vocals. Eventually, over a period of 3 months, he knew what it was about, and it was about Richard's, you know, suicide with the band and how he missed him. So it turned into quite a special song.
Wow.
Thought I'd bring us all down to level there.
Mission accomplished.
Working in weird places.
Well, I have written even slower songs and moodier.
Put that gun down, Rob.
Andrew, you ever worked in any bizarre place or done any tracking, anything weird? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the last time I did tracking in what you'd call a proper studio. I mean, I'm constantly building studios in weird places. I mean, I've just recorded an album in a 500-seat concert hall for 3 months. But, I mean, I've done editing at my parents' kitchen table because, like, it's got to get done, and I'm flying out somewhere, and, like, okay, you just set up there and work. And even all my mixing, I mean, I have all the proper gear, but it's my garage, basically. Mm. So I never work in a place that you wouldn't say is weird. And it's great for exactly the reasons he was talking about, because it just keeps your mindset on listening to what's going on. You're not worried about, oh, my God, what are we paying an hour for this place?
Yeah.
I always prefer the vibe of you brought up a good point, and I think you must probably agree. As an engineer, when I used to engineer with lots of guys in the room, lots of times when they weren't gelling and everything, I'd end up popping things out the mix. So they'd end up just getting two mics or so, because they don't, you know, so the drummer doesn't hear his ride. So it's like, he's inhibited to play, or the rhythm guitar play. Don't let him hear himself too much, because he can dig in and
get him into the
sound.
Into the band.
Yeah.
And psychologically, I mean, people worry about what they're paying at a studio, and you'd think that what they really want to do is to be able to work just 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I've found whenever I'm not in a studio, I work many fewer hours. If I'm in a studio, people realize they're paying for 12, you got to work all 12.
Right.
They're paying for 6 days, you got to work 6 days. Anybody who just sets up in a house to make a record ends up working 5 days a week, reasonable hours.
And it is, you know, there's something about just not being at your normal place that's kind of cool. I mean, I know when I was working in the hospital, it was a really good escape for me just to kind of put myself into it. And so I felt like I was really concentrating a lot more. But even more so this time, I mean, I've done, you know, sound effects editing in the library. Properly motivated, you'll pretty much work anywhere. I working with Martin on his tour, we were changing things around, and I got a laptop, and I was working, you know, on a taxi, and then on the way to the and then on the airplane, you know, and programming and things like that. It's just
I do Ableton live tracks on the plane.
Yeah,
the headphones. I do.
Yeah,
play around, have fun. Sit there, go play, and guys go, "What the hell are you doing?" I'm going, "Oh, listen to this," and go, "Oh."
Well, it's just amazing that technology allows you to, nowadays, you can pretty much work anywhere.
Yeah, it's not easy to bring a studer onto a jumbo jet, is it?
The first couple of steps are a bit tough, but once you get in there, once you get in through,
you have to buy a seat for it.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, it's true. That's true. They won't put it in the emergency exit.
Hard.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I mean, if you're going down, what would you do? You say, "Look, I'm going to store this tails out first." So
and also you have to sit next to somebody who knows how to punch. And
right, exactly. You can't get good punches. I tell you, they're always slow. Must be the altitude, like in.
They always
British Airways, you're quite good at punching.
All right.
If there was a way to get a studer on the plane, though, I know a guy who would have had one on a plane.
No doubt.
Yeah,
you do.
Stevie, right?
Yeah, no question.
Speaking of Stevie, I mean, I remember being on tour with him and his little tour rig that you've worked on several different versions of that.
Stories about working in weird places. I have some.
Tell us some.
I mean, when I first started with Stevie, on tour. I guess the first tour I did with him was in 86 and it ended up going on for a really long time. But we were using Synclaviers and all kinds of big computer equipment, and that tour was in the round. So we'd be playing these giant arenas, and the stage would be set up in the middle, and then they actually hired a magician to help figure out how to get Stevie onto the stage each night, which was pretty cool. They used to use all these secret compartments and things. It was actually really cool. But I had Synclaviers set up under the stage, and I used to have to edit with headphones tracks to be played that night, or, you know, backing tracks or edit, you know, orchestral tracks or whatever. The show was changing constantly. First of all, it was so loud under the stage that I used to have an assistant hold the headphones onto my ears extra tight because I couldn't hear otherwise.
Was he paid and hired just to do that?
No, he paid Rob to do that.
Yeah, exactly. That was a dream gig. But the other thing that added to the difficulty here is that if you stood up, the stage would take your head off because it was this stage that had to be built every night that rotated. And it had these girders that would go around underneath. It was a big stage. I mean, it was probably 30 or 40 feet across.
Man beheaded at Stevie Wonder gig.
Could have happened.
I envisioned you said you had a magician bring Stevie on. I'm thinking you get a stand-in for the night, and he's amateur. You go down and you see Clav's gone. He's like, he's made it disappear.
No, that never happened either. You know what? Hiring a magician was actually a really good idea because when you do a show in the round, you can't bring things to the stage without everybody seeing it.
Right. Did he wear a cape or anything?
Not that I recall.
I just, you know, seeing a guy wander around in the cape. It's our magician. It's our tour magician.
You know what? I used to wear the cape because, you know, I was really proud of having the Stevie gig, and I just wanted people to know.
Well, you should have.
Super geek.
Oh, no. No, you weren't one of those guys that wore the tour jacket everywhere.
No,
you?
Not at all.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're wearing your podcast jacket.
The laminate alert when you're walking down. Yeah.
That's right.
There's always one.
What's up with those guys that wear the laminate and the jacket, like,
everywhere.
Everywhere. In the mall.
Well, they're the same
they're
guys
new.
Who will say that they're in the band.
Right. Well, you know what? Here, I have one for you. And this, I will not mention names, though anyone who toured probably with us knew who I'm talking about. But there was one person on our tour who actually, we did a tour that didn't have jackets, and they had their own jacket made up.
Oh.
Yeah, I was on that tour and did not get a jacket. And then I saw this guy with a tour jacket
or
from
girl.
His tour.
This guy or girl.
Or girl. I'm thinking like, well, how come I didn't get one? What did I screw
poor
up?
God. Oh, that's classic.
Man.
Especially if they spelled the name of the artist wrong, too.
No, it was that was
sad. Actually.
That's classic.
Wow, that's bad. I mean, it's I classic. Thought wearing the laminate to the mall was bad, but that beats it by far.
Yeah, that was pretty extreme. But so anyway, so that Synclavier stuff under the stage at 100 dB of noise all around you, the subwoofer for this whole tour went around the perimeter of the stage. So I was set up basically with my back to this wall of subwoofers that was feeding the auditorium.
That explains a lot about you.
It does. Yeah, you know what, though? That bass felt so good. There are definitely worse places to hear a Stevie Wonder concert from. It was pretty cool.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a total nightmare, though, if anything went wrong, because you were in the middle of an arena with, you know, 20,000 screaming people or whatever. So maintenance wasn't the easiest thing. But I've ended up working – check this out. On that same tour is when computers got small enough that they were considered portable or able to be portable, but they weren't battery powered. So we used to, I think we talked about this on another podcast, we used to carry on a plane so Stevie could work on a plane, a portable computer, and then like a lawnmower extension cable that we would run down the aisle of the plane and plug into the shaver socket in the bathroom. I don't even
did
know
the
if
magician fly with you?
No, he
did. He travel.
He, no, he's
no, he just
in
poof
him.
From you know, just snap his fingers and disappear.
I'm fascinated with this magician.
That was the magician.
I'll get you his number.
We're gonna take a break now, and when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about patients in the studio.
And I got something to bring up too that we have to discuss.
All right,
ooh. So we'll talk about that.
We're gonna take
ooh,
a break.
A teaser,
and
teaser.
I'm gonna catch you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before we took a break, Andrew kind of teased this with something really interesting. So, Andrew, what is it that you wanted to talk about?
Well, it's a little something that happened in the audio industry yesterday in that Radiohead started selling their new album. And for the little bit of backstory is that Radiohead are not under contract to anybody. Their last album fulfilled their contract. They haven't signed. There's been speculation for years now about what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Because everyone's assuming what they do is going to kind of show us the direction that things can go in, because they're bold, they don't care, and they're big enough that they'll sell records no matter how they decide to do it.
Right.
So the way they decided to do it is by, first of all, a couple of weeks ago, there were all these emails floating around saying, oh, well, the album won't be out till next year. Then on Friday, apparently, Johnny Greenwood posted on their website, oh, by the way, you'll be able to pre-order the download of the record on Monday, and you'll get it October 10th, and pay whatever you want. And you can also, if you feel like it, buy a multi-disc set. So basically what they're selling is a download that you can buy for 1p, so basically 2 cents if you want, plus 45 cents for processing the credit card transaction. Or you can pay whatever you want, but the minimum you can pay is 1p, just because they have to process something. Or you can pay $80 and get a CD, two vinyl, so it's a double album on like heavy vinyl, plus an extra CD with 8 more tracks, plus some book with a lot of photography and stuff. So an amazing package priced kind of high at $80, or you can spend 5 cents and buy the digital download. And I just think it's a pretty bold move. And they say that they're going to have more of a traditional CD release next year. But, I mean, my first thought was that it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that's pretty brilliant, because you take the piracy right off the...
Yeah, and I'm sure people will still, you know, oh, I got it, and some people won't buy it, but I think most people will buy it. And what I'm really looking forward to is finding out how many people bought it and what they paid. Because I will bet that most people paid a reasonable amount for it.
Is it only being sold really through downloads?
Yeah, and only through their website.
Yep.
Okay, so will it be monitored for chart action?
Don't know.
Yeah.
They haven't said yet. And I think it could be, because now downloads are monitored for charts, except I think they only monitor through certain sites, like
That's
iTunes
right.
and things like that. Whereas this – and the – they can't sell it on iTunes because iTunes forces you to sell it for $9.99.
Right.
You don't have a choice about that.
They probably don't care about the chart entry anyway.
No, yeah, that's what I don't think say. They do. I mean, other people are mentioning about how they've been in the top 10 3 times and don't they want to know. But what will probably happen is if it turns out that they say, well, we've sold 6 million downloads of this, then they will change the chart rules
so
that it can be number one.
Yeah.
And if it sells, you know, 50,000, then no one will care and they won't bother.
Total independence.
Is it on Limelight yet? I mean, I'd be interesting to see when the record comes out how quickly it becomes on the peer-to-peers.
I'm sure it'll go up immediately.
Yeah, it'll go up immediately. I mean, but it's, you know, when you figure you can pay practically nothing
for it right.
and have a...
What I like about it is actually a vote of like, oh, I support these guys. I want to give them an extra, you know, pay 50 cents or whatever, you know, the average price for one song or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
Is it one song or the whole album?
No, it's the whole album. So you can buy the whole album for 1p plus the credit card transaction fee.
Perhaps you can help me, Martin, but what would the charts buy you? Why would you want to be charted?
Well, this is you know, what Andrew was saying, really. If you look at their website and the way they are, they're, they're, in a way, you know, revolutionaries in the way they see everything. You know, they it's very radical the way they do their stuff, and their music has been exceptional in making people think differently. I don't think they're looking for chart success. I think they're basically looking to do something different and really open up the independent market to make us think differently. You know, and they're in that position to do it. You know, and they had to go through many years of just doing the normal rounds.
Right.
But the way they're looked upon is as groundbreaking. You know, and they're not really, in a way, I think, seeking the commercial thing as much as saying, look what you can all do, and we're going to be the first to do it. We're in this situation to do it. So I don't think the chart thing will be a big deal, but I do think it would be interesting, as Bobby was saying, I think they will like everybody to know how much they've done this way, you know. Obviously, everybody does, you know. So I think, but I don't think they're really looking at the charts at all. They're obviously making a statement of saying we're getting on a separate train to everybody else, you know.
And obviously, they can do this model because they're established.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, a new band can't do this, but because they'll go on tour. But they've also been doing things that bands used to do. They toured most of the material for this album last year because they were bored of being in the studio. And I went and saw them, and there were 8 songs I'd never heard before out of maybe 18 that they played. So they're actually touring new material before they record it.
Wow, that's...
And they're releasing it when it's done and on their own terms. I mean, literally less than a month ago, all the information was that this album was not coming out this year, and they must have just gotten bored with that. They started probably looking at the licensing deals and things like that, and they want to do short press and long press, and the earliest it could be out is January. And the band's sitting around saying, nah, I don't think so. We'll put it out on Monday. And that's what they did.
That's pretty awesome.
Do you think it's going to help new bands? I mean,
I don't see how it can help new bands. Right, because I think what they're feeling is if everybody pays 1p and nobody buys the multi-disc box, well, they'll just go sell out some arenas and tour.
Right, right.
And that's where they're going to make their money anyway.
And they're obviously a great band and a greatly established, a well-established band. So the young bands, a new band coming out, they've got that competition of those fans if they wanted to get those fans saying, well, hey, I can buy Radiohead for 1p. Why would I pay 20,
yeah.
5p?
Well, and they're also reading all the articles. I mean, it was on the front page of the LA Times today in the news section, not even the calendar section. And it's funny how some of the articles are very quick to point out that Radiohead, on the back of 10 years of marketing that has done for them by the labels, which, you know, I don't know about that. I mean, their creep was because of a radio station that picked it up and started playing it.
Yeah, but
they've gotten help.
Yeah, they've gotten help. You can't say that they haven't because there is a, you know, OK Computer, you saw tons of in-store, you know, displays and all that stuff has to get paid for.
I think what's a great thing, though, is it's made us talk about it, and it's obviously a new way of thinking about things. It really does go under your skin about thinking about independence, and I'm sure even for people that aren't, you know, as big as Radiohead, they'll look at this and go, something's happening that is different.
Well, yeah, and people have been saying for a long time that the labels are only good for established acts, but I think their point is, well, what good are they for an established act?
That's the,
right.
But you know what? It'll be really the most important thing. I mean, obviously they're getting a lot of buzz from this, and they'll sell a bunch. But the only thing that's going to really change the industry is if we can find out for real how well this does.
Yeah,
to see whether this is actually a valid
and
path.
I would think because of that, they'll tell people. Like, for themselves, they probably don't even care because they're giving it away. So they have to be prepared that nobody's actually going to buy it, that there's going to be one kid in the Ukraine who pays for it, gets it on the peer-to-peer, and that's it. But I think when they realize that the information coming out is actually going to affect the industry, I think it'll come out.
I think, you know, who's
going
to benefit from this the most? I think it's all the bands that don't get their sophomore album, you know, is how many times, or don't get their third album. You know, if they see, you hear bands all the time that get a good number one on their first album and then they get dropped before their second album, or they get a second album and that doesn't do so well and then they get dropped before their third album. I think it's going to be
an established base. I mean, we've said it a million times in a million different conversations is that if you're making all the money from selling your records, you don't need to sell as many records. You need to sell a few and you're making a living as a musician and that's it. And this, you know, they're going to make an awfully good living.
Yeah.
Well, there's always the issue of paying for promotion, though, because they have a huge, obviously, established fan base that's going to go to their website and do this.
Yeah.
But for a new band that didn't get a sophomore album, they might try to do the same thing. But if people don't know to go to their website or their MySpace page or whatever.
But the only reason people knew to go to Radiohead's website is because as soon as anything happens with Radiohead, Pitchfork and NME and all of these other places that people go to hear about music pick up on it. If you've had a successful album in the UK and you do anything, NME will report it. So I think for a slightly successful band that's had one album come out, you actually get a lot of free publicity on the blogs and on all these music news pages because they'll follow it and they spread it. Radiohead did not promote this at all as far as I know. I mean, the only thing that I saw that came directly from the band was, dear fans, buy our record on Monday from the website, see you, Johnny. Like, that was it. So all the publicity is actually coming from people picking it up as a news item.
It's amazing how the internet has just become, you know, so effective at doing things like promoting yourself, you know, and just creating your own quiet little storm, your own quiet little, revolution. I look at Martin and your marketing of just getting in touch with your fans again, and you look at your MySpace page.
I'm actually doing something even more rebellious. I'm paying people to buy my record.
But obviously not enough.
Yeah.
But I look at like your MySpace page and you're already up to, 630 some odd friends, but but at such a low key marketing level. I mean, other than just, you know, a mention here on the podcast every now and then, really that's just kind of been its own, its own thing.
And what it proves is that instead of a band or an artist putting out their own thing and trying to get a grassroots thing going so that they can then get to what everybody has been trying to attain, which is the label contract. It's like, well, no, you've attained it by just selling it yourself and you're done. That's as far as you need to go with that. Because the band, like we've been saying, they're going to make money touring. They're not going to – I mean, they could make an incredible amount of money selling this multi-disc box thing.
Right.
But if they don't sell a lot of those, they're going to make the money elsewhere. And that's the way I think every artist has to make it now.
Right.
Now,
Tiffany,
let me ask you guys this. Who's going to be the power brokers? If the labels are going to lose – some of their status. Who's going to be the power brokers? Are we going to see a new generation of maybe guys that are great at internet marketing and maybe set up like not necessarily labels, but maybe just, you know, channels or something?
Well, my feeling is that it's going to be places like Pitchfork and Enemy who already have a lot of influence in terms of when something comes out, if Pitchfork pans it, that makes some people immediately go buy it because they really polarize people. A lot of people hate Pitchfork. But it's a place people go to learn
about
music.
What is,
PitchforkMedia.com. And it's mostly on the slightly more indie side of bands, but a lot of mainstream artists, and they review things, and they have scathing reviews. They love to say they hate things. And so that's just the kind of site they are. Whereas NME is an English – it's a magazine, but it also their website has news updated all the time, and they're more mainstream. New Music Express. Thanks, Bob. And there are a bunch of sites like that, and I personally haven't – gotten into it too much, but apparently MP3 blogging is a big deal where just people are reviewing music and they put an MP3 of it there so people can hear it. And I think that's going to be the network where people hear about it.
I think the wonderful thing, the really great thing about this, the whole new idea with the internet and everybody, the MySpace and everybody doing their own thing, is that you can really find your audience. You know, if you're, as Andrew says, if you press up, you know, 1,000 albums and you sell 1,000 and you look at, hey, we're not going to be able to do an EPK, we're not going to be able to do this or that, but we're going to hit three places and these are the people that like what we do, then you've really got a chance of getting through. And in the old scheme of things, you were lost on a record label. You know, if you sounded like Neil Diamond, they'd try you there, you're lost, you're out, you know. But now you can really sort of find the people that are into what you do. You can link up and you can network with other artists that sound a bit like you. And you can find your own audience if you put a little bit of work into it. I think that's what's really quite brilliant, you know, that a person that maybe in the earlier 70s and 80s, if he didn't have a major record contract and he might have been good, and if he missed his first single, didn't get on the radio, he was gone. Now you can say, okay, I can go onto MySpace, I can go onto a few different web-oriented things, and I can think a little different about doing it myself and finding the audience that I think I can appeal to.
Right.
I think that's really a big difference today.
So have we seen the end of showcases where you, as a band, you try to do showcase to get the,
not at all.
To get the,
they're still happening.
The label? I mean, why?
Because the major labels still do need acts.
Okay.
I mean, there aren't as many major labels, but the ones that are there still need product.
And
some people don't want to do it.
They're going to spend money.
And some people just don't want to do all that, the work it takes to do it.
That's a good point.
There's work to do.
And some people's personalities are not geared to that. Some
exactly.
People are just like, let me write songs. Yeah.
Let's face it. If all the stars do align and you do end up with a major label contract and you are their main push and they do decide to throw a ton of resources behind you and they do put, you know, $2 or $3 million behind you to get you out there, you can't do that yourself. You can't be an overnight multi-zillion dollar success without having that kind of money behind you. I mean, if all of a sudden overnight they can put you on every billboard and every magazine and every bus and every everything, you know, live television, whatever.
Here's a huge thing though, psychologically now, is that, you know, an artist can sit down and say, you know, I don't really want to do that and I still want to communicate. So I think it comes down to, in this age, that artists have to think about a great deal about what they want to achieve.
Sure,
you know, I want to be on TV. I want to do this. I want to do that.
I'm just saying there are people who still want that, and the label system may still be the only way to do that.
Sure.
And maybe it happens to one person a year or two people a year. It's not like the odds are good at all. I don't think anybody should go for it personally. But there is still a label system out there, and there are still showcases, and there are still A&R people who sign people, and people do get million-dollar advances. And
that's why I think it's a good point for people that are listening to think about, you know, what do I want to achieve?
Yeah, don't try for that. It doesn't work.
And no, what I mean is to say, if you think, you know, is that what I want to do, or, you know, do I just want to play locally? Which you can do now and still do well. So it's particularly now, I think artists really have to think about what do I want to achieve? Think a little deeper about saying, I can do this different ways.
Sure.
And I think that's where, a band or an artist or a songwriter or performing songwriter can think now with the internet and say, what do I want to do? Do I want to be Britney Spears, or do I want to think about doing this a little different and finding my own audience and not going all the way? You know?
Oh, sorry, just going to say, I mean, I think a big point about what Radiohead's doing specifically is not that's the new model.
Right.
The model is there's no model.
Right.
They came up with something that would work for them, with a pricing structure that would work for them and for their fan base. I mean, their fan base will spend $80 on a multi-disc box because it's going to have a book and extra songs. I mean, I did in 5 seconds. But the point is they just looked at what they've got and who they're selling to.
You bought the disc box?
Oh, of course.
Can I copy it?
Yeah. Of course. But you have to look at what makes sense for what you do, and that's how you sell your music.
Yeah, yeah. That's totally what I'm trying to say.
I think what we're going to see is, believe it or not, as the record labels tend to be looking like they're getting a little deflated, I think we're actually going to see more companies get into music, though, on a marketing level, because with the internet and the fact that you don't have to have an inventory and you can do things, you don't have to own a pressing plant or anything like that. You know, look at Starbucks. They got into music. You know, what's to keep Apple from getting into music and media? You're going to start to see, I think, some companies come out of the blue and start opening up their, you know, whatever they call it, whether it's going to be their new media division or their digital media division. But I think there's actually going to be more competition and more of these corporate marketing companies that are going to get involved with music. I think Starbucks is the first one, but you're going to see some other people go follow that same route. So I think
Starbucks have that way where they know, you know, the people are going to walk in and buy their coffees and see that album right in the front. You know, today I saw Bruce Springsteen's in there, and, right. You know, new Fogerty record and Joni Mitchell. Paul McCartney got top three with that because, you know, people, you're stood in there buying your coffee. You've got the money to spend in Starbucks. So the audience has a certain amount of money to spend because you've got to spend a lot of money to get coffee in a place like that. So you buy the Paul McCartney album as well.
But what's to stop Apple from doing that? I've heard Apple, you know, has been looking into getting into media and looking into distributing.
Well,
and
only their deal with Apple Records. I don't think they're allowed to. Didn't that just come up again? And
yeah, it did.
They were in trouble again for...
I wish I knew where I read, but they were looking for programming for their for iTunes. It may not be music. This could be like film or television or only that
right.
line. But if you were a big – like Google, I mean, there's no reason why Google couldn't get into the record business.
Absolutely. And I think there are a lot of companies looking at it differently too, where they're looking at branding music so that instead of it being Starbucks selling a Paul McCartney record, it's Starbucks selling the Starbucks record. And then the artist from that record may be able to get a career aside of that, but it's actually their own branded music.
That's got to happen.
Yeah, every single thing will have a theme song. It's like writing national anthems. There will be an entire industry of people writing music for companies as opposed to companies putting out other people's music.
But here's also the thing as far as companies adding, you know, their own media and coming up with their own product like that. It works for Starbucks because, like you guys were saying, people are already in the mindset to spend way too much for a cup of coffee in there. So buying a CD is no big deal.
And it's in their face.
It's right in your face, and it's a very appealing kind of setting. And most of the customers who are in there, if they have the money to spend that much on coffee, they do have enough for a CD. But, you know, companies are also very aware of the fact that when it comes to downloads and things like that, you know, people share music and music is not something the public is being trained to want to spend money on. They're being trained that it's something they can get for free, you know, with LimeWire and all the other peer-to-peer things. So I think companies are going to think twice before getting all excited about developing their own product that is just not going to be that big of a moneymaker necessarily.
Well, that's why it'll be their own thing.
One thing I do want to bring up is I was working with Rob Friday night on a project that we're doing for API. And for the first time, I actually got to sit in the studio and watch Rob work. And we were kind of under a deadline, and it was late at night. And I saw him actually, you know, he had to compose a little song and record it. And it was actually pretty interesting because we had to tempo map a Led Zeppelin song and then – and then write a song that was the same tempo, and it was Led Zeppelin, so they weren't playing to a click track. So it was all over the map as far as tempo goes.
They were far from playing to a click track, that's for sure.
But one thing
good
I wanted to...
stuff.
The tempo was... On the sheet music, the tempo would have said in the 90s.
Yeah, really.
90-ish.
Yeah.
But it was really fascinating to watch Rob work. And one thing I noticed is even though we were kind of in a time crunch, mainly because it was so late, Rob was really methodical and really patient as to how he worked and how he got things done. And
that surprises me, actually. Doesn't it? I wouldn't think he was that kind of guy. Yeah.
Methodical, no,
yeah,
not at all.
Yeah, surprised. But, the way he dresses and everything. So.
But
it must be that Vicodin, I think.
But yeah. He, you know,
no, that was upstairs. We didn't even hit the Vicodin that night.
Such an undisciplined guy. I'm amazed about this. Really.
But he started at the he started with his drums and he got the beat and we moved forward. And I wanted to bring that up because, a lot of times, sometimes if you're working under a deadline or a crunch, you know, some people tend to rush through things, and I know I tend to rush through things. But I wanted to bring up patience and how important is patience, even when you're working on a killer deadline or when you're trying to write a song. It just seems to me that if you can just spend a few moments and just kind of catch your breath and just kind of keep your head clear, you'll be much more effective and you'll really put out a better product than if you let the weight of, your deadline or you try to force things. And, Martin, when you're writing a song, how important is it for you just to be patient with the whole process and not try to force things?
I think it's everything, really. That's just a really crucial thing. I mean, I think time is a collaborator on writing songs or anything. You know, it's difficult in the studio when you're doing, the technical side because, as you say, you have deadlines, but for writing, and it wasn't the same when you're younger. You want to rush through things because you've got so much to say and you're not sure what you're saying and you're not sure how to edit yourself. But as the years go on and you carry on doing it, you start to realize that time is really, really important because things settle into the air. I'll write a bridge or a middle eight, and then the next day I'll come in and I'll hear it clearer the next day and think that was a good move or that wasn't a good move. But as you're doing it, it's a little hard to tell, until you step back. When I was younger writing, that was the big crucial thing. You didn't know how to edit yourself and you're just pleased that you got a result, that you're making noise. But as you get older, you care about a little more and you see the subtleties of things. So to me, particularly now at my age and time is really, really important, and patience is huge. If you're not sure, back away. I'm talking about writing, even probably with mixing to a certain degree, you go, I think we've got it, but let's listen to it again tomorrow. My biggest test is putting things on cassette and then going, after being here for 3 hours, going home and playing it fresh out of the blue and then going, oh, bad move, that chord doesn't resonate, So to me, I think we said it on the interview in the EPK we were doing, that I think now more than anything, it's letting creativity soak into the wood, soak into your clothes, and sit back and just go, I think it's good, but let me feel if it's good. And usually you can't, in anything in life, you can't really tell always straight on. Sometimes you do, but that's a collaborator to me. Time is impatience, big time.
Andrew, when you're mixing and if you're under a killer deadline, how do you have that discipline to not, or do you have the discipline to not just want to throw things up and just kind of, let's let the compression work a little harder, or is it your method that kind of helps you with those crunch times?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, if I'm mixing rock stuff, there are things that I know will work and you kind of know what bits of things are supposed to sound like. But in terms of being able to finish it, it's exactly what Martin was saying. You have to get away from it and it's got to sink in. So if I have a deadline and I know I have to finish, rather than just sit in front of it and really try and get it done, I'll just work in bursts and I'll force myself to leave the studio, even if it's only for 10 minutes.
Right.
And just like, okay, I'm going to crank on the drums for a minute and then I'm going to leave and then come back in and you hit play and like, all right, the drums aren't good, or drums are fine, got to move on. And you can really keep your perspective going by just stopping. Or you think you're losing perspective on the drums, mute the drums and start finding the right vocal effect. Just get away from them completely, because whenever you hear them fresh, whether it's overnight, which is ideal, or even if it's 5 minutes later, as long as you can focus on something else, then you can come back to it. But
I've got to add to what Andrew's saying is, you know, particularly as he's in his mixing place, and sometimes it's nice to walk out of the room and play it in the distance. Go and make a cup of tea and listen to the track playing. For me, it's like listening to another room. And you are already looking at different things with your eyes, and you're thinking about different things, and you're making the tea, and this music's playing behind you, and you know it's you, you can feel the colors of it, and then you'll just feel different, and you'll hear it differently, not on top of it, but it's drifting away from you, and you're walking around in another room.
You know, most of the best engineers I've ever worked with do that very thing. They'll go and listen from the back of the room or from the next room. You know, it really gives you a great clear perspective.
My NS10s are now on the floor facing the corner.
Yeah.
And it's always, when I switch to those, it's in mono and they're quiet, and it's as so I don't have to get up from the chair and I can even work on the mix, but it's as if it's playing from another room.
Oh, that's kind of cool. That's a great idea.
It forces you to just listen differently, but that's not really patience. That's just more getting away from it. But when recording with people, you have to have infinite patience, because someone might get it on the first take and then you have to convince them that they don't need to keep working on it because it was unbelievable. But a lot of times the idea just has to come to fruition, and it can take forever. And you may even know, I'll bet if you did this, it would help. But you also hopefully have a sense of their personality to know, if I tell him what he needs to do, it's going to ruin the whole day.
Right.
So, and you just sit and you work and you try to like poke him a little bit and get people to move in different directions. But you have to be supremely patient when you're working with other people.
Yeah, well, I can imagine, especially with the vocalist, you're not exactly going to say, hey, you can do it like this, you know, because I bet sometimes
Bobby does. Bobby tells him quick.
Yeah, I'll do it. So look, if you don't do it like this, I'm going to kick you.
I'm going to put auto tune on you.
You're fired.
Hey, Bobby, when you have you work under extreme deadlines,
sometimes,
and how do you just not freak out? You know, when you
see, I'm lucky. I seem to kind of get more focused when I've got a serious deadline. Literally, like a 7 or 8 hour deadline to deliver something. My wife's actually great with this because she knows when I'm spinning around trying to catch my own tail, and she says to me, she's like, take a break. And it's a lesson to learn to force myself to take a break. I definitely, like Andrew says, when I was a mixer, I used to do the same thing. I used to disappear on my own, you know, butt, basically trying to get the drums down and go, you know, I'm not going anywhere with this. Let me just, you know, I'm going to do the background vocals. Let's just put this in, get some patching going, do the busy work and take your mind off that. Off of listening, it's definitely knowing your own personality, and also not freaking out, knowing that you know, if you think, oh, if I don't get this done, I'm gonna get fired. They're gonna never call me again.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That's your biggest fear. Or listen, the guy's leaving on the plane tomorrow. The record's going to the master's, but I've got to get this done.
Right.
This is the single. The A&R guy's coming and never listen to it. That you can't let that get to you. You have to have faith in yourself. Of course. You know, we've all got the ability to get certain places. You've got to have faith in yourself. So I can nail this. You know, there's a saying I always say, I prefer to have something, you know, when it comes to a deadline, certainly, I prefer to have something great in 8 hours' time than have something brilliant tomorrow, because, you know, you got to say, okay, this is, you know, certainly when I'm writing for something, I say, okay, this idea has worked. I'll throw 4 or 5 of them. And then once I've got the idea, I've got, okay, now I've got to arrange this and get this to some sort of sound production. So there's 2 stages.
Right.
So once I've settled on whatever the thing is, I say, okay, now produce it. And okay, now I'm producing. I'm not changing. I'm not going to change horses. Although granted, if I had the luxury of standing back for a day, listening and go, you know, that really does suck. That progression just doesn't work. I should have done something else. But, you know, sometimes it's best to, you know, of course, my job as it is now these days is quite different, but it's policing yourself and knowing yourself and being strict and saying, yeah, I'm going to walk away for 10 minutes. I need to. I don't have 10 minutes. I've got to keep working. And you walk away for 10 minutes and it really does.
And the magic happens.
Well, your perspective happens.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, one thing I noticed is it seems I can definitely tell that you've composed for a while, because you had total confidence in what you were going to do. And you had your mythology all worked out, and it was just, you know, even when we're at dinner, you know, and you're like, you're just all calm and, you know, not giving anything a second thought. Not that I thought you were going
to
worry about
it. Was I supposed to sit at dinner all terrified?
No.
Drugs, that's it.
No, but it was just, there was just a great,
rock and roll.
It was just really, you know, there was just some confidence in watching the way you work, you've done it so long, you can just rely on that
confidence. I've done it a billion times.
And you have your mythology all worked out.
Well, I've done it, one thing is I have done it a billion times, but I have a few philosophies that I've developed over the years that kind of keep me calm in those kinds of situations, because I've had the crazy deadlines that Bobby has also. It's just a part of, especially if you're in the promo world, that's just part of life. But, you know, the person who taught me how to basically write and record music was Stevie. He's the first person, actually he's really the only person I ever worked for in the music industry. He definitely gave me my start, and for years and years I was with him doing albums and watching him write and watching him produce and producing with him and all that kind of thing. And I talked to him, I mean, we've had endless conversations about it, but he taught me that he believes anything he would record and commit to tape or disc or anything else could be forever. You know, anything you do might make a permanent mark till the end of time. You never know. And in his case, you know, he's recorded plenty of things that have truly impacted generation after generation and will continue to do that. And so he takes everything he does very seriously, and nothing is ever done frivolously. I mean, you can have fun, and you have to have fun, and it can be light and it can be entertaining to work on this stuff. But you do have to keep in mind that this might be something you're doing for the ages that could affect people hundreds of years from now, and it has some weight to it. And I realized as I spent years with him that anything you do that's great, nobody cares how long it took you to do it. They don't care whether you wrote the song in 5 minutes or 5 years. Generally, the ones you wrote in 5 minutes turn out better for whatever reason. At least in my case, that's just the way it works. Because if the ideas come out that smoothly, I mean, I've watched Stevie write hundreds of songs, and a lot of them, he just sits down at the piano and the chorus comes out with a framework of lyrics, you know, not all the lyrics, but the basic nugget of lyrics, and it turns out to be just great. And I think, you know, he's at a different level than most people, but I think anybody, if an idea just clicks real fast, it's usually an easy idea to move on with and have it be great. But any project I'm doing, like that night last Friday when we were working on that little musical piece, I was tired, it was late, but more important to me than the fact that I'm tired and it's late is we're working on a piece of music that's going to go on a DVD. Lots of people are going to check it out. I don't want to be apologizing for it 5 years from now when I hear it and say, oh, well, we did it late. That's why it sounds like crap.
Yeah, right now on DVD.
Yeah, exactly.
The late mix,
sorry.
Right. Well, it'll be the opening of the DVD, and then during the menu, you'll just hear me apologizing for how terrible the opening. You know, I take, even if I'm doing a, even if I'm doing a light, little frivolous piece of music, I don't think of it as frivolous because you never know what's going to take off. I mean, the most famous commercial I ever wrote is for Hot Pockets. I mean, it's incredibly hilarious to me that such an
is that
awful
Hot Pockets? Hot Pockets?
Yeah,
is
I that wrote that. I thought we'd covered that at some point.
No, I think you did. I think you did tell me.
On the first podcast.
Maybe so, because I'm still bitter about it because it was a buyout. I did learn a lesson. Yeah,
and the singer was a buyout too?
Yeah. Boy, she wasn't happy either.
I bet not.
But we did that in, I think, December of 1990. I mean, I was brand new and my company was brand new. Anyway, you know, I did as good a job as I could with it. It's not that I feel like I did a terrible job with it.
But you should apologize. You're right, carry on. Well,
you know what?
We're listening.
Sometimes the assignment's embarrassing, and that was an embarrassing assignment. But you never know. If someone had told me, by the way, this is your first commercial, and maybe not forever, but for a long time, this may be your best-known commercial, I would have been horrified. So I try to do everything now.
But you wear the tour jacket with Hot Pockets.
Well, I had it made. It cost me a fortune.
Looks good on you.
He's still got Hot Pockets actually written looks on his T-shirt.
It's a beautiful jacket and it's microwave.
I like it. Yes. If only they could see it. It looks great on you, mate. Looks great. Oh.
Well, the point I'm getting to is last Friday, even though we were tired and it's late and everything else, right, it strikes me that what we're working on might end up being heard by a lot of people who are going to know that we did it.
Right.
And no one's going to care that we did it late. No one's going to care about any of that. So, yeah, I mean, if I'm getting tired, it's harder to focus. But the most important thing to me is that you feel like you gave it your best shot, no matter what it is.
I think that's a good point, though. It's actually it's important when you stop caring about whatever job you're doing, it's time to
you
kind of change shit.
Because you say no one's going to care that you did it on Friday. No one's going to know you did it on Friday.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah.
They're going to think you did your best shot.
Had I felt that the music was suffering because it was getting so late, I would have said, listen, let's pick it up tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's not worth doing a terrible job.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the patience that you saw in me, I'm not a particularly patient person at all, but I'm used to what it takes to get a certain job done.
Right.
And one of the things I think a successful producer or musician or anybody in that capacity has to do in the studio is you might be frantic up until that moment of creativity, but once it's time to sit down and actually work on the music or write the lyric or sing the vocal or whatever, you need to be able to almost flick like a switch
right
into that mode. Yeah. I mean, I can have a horrendous, chaotic day, but at night, if I have to write a piece of classical piano music or whatever, I've trained myself over the years to kind of flick a switch and get into that mindset. Yeah. I don't think that's easy to do when you're starting out. I think it's harder to get into that headspace.
Sure.
But I think that's the key, and I think that's what you subconsciously notice on Friday, because that's the only way to get the music done is to be in that headspace.
Well, I just think it was very not forced, and I've worked with people and I've collaborated with other people where, you know, you're working late at night and it just gets really, you can just tell how they're forcing it, they're pushing it, and I just think, you know, patience really pays off.
And I think it comes with experience in any part of creativity, really.
All right, gang. Well, we're gonna wrap this up right now. And wow, this was this was a pretty interesting podcast. And before we go, I wanted to mention a few things. Number one, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. The second thing is yes, we are going to be doing a video cast as soon as Rob Steele is 100%. And
I'm not enjoying working on milk crates, but it will be done one of these one of these.
Oh, that's right. You're still waiting for your furniture.
Yeah. Weren't we talking about that 17 podcasts ago?
Okay. Well, Rob, you have anything you're working on that you want to plug? Anything you can talk about?
You know what? I've been sort of hinting at it for a while, and I think I'm maybe one more podcast away from being able to make a big announcement that has a lot to do with a lot of the stuff we've been talking about tonight. So if I got a little bit heated about stuff, it's because I've spent the last few months researching my brains out about a new venture, and I should be able to talk about it either next podcast or the one after.
Great. We'll look forward to that. Andrew?
Well, a couple little things. Finishing up some tracks with a local band I've been producing who at the moment are calling themselves Pretenderloin, which is quite a bit of fun to say.
Pretenderloin.
But they might be going under the Bush Twins. I don't know, but whatever. Some good rock stuff.
Say more.
Yeah. And I'm also teaching a class at the UCLA Extension.
Oh,
which
that's
is
great.
Fun.
Oh, that's amazing.
The guy who was going to teach it bailed right at the last second, so it started up on 2 days' notice. But it's good. It's a class I've taught before. It's just a.
What class is it?
The Fundamentals of Acoustics and Audio.
Wow.
Interesting. So it's actually.
And then do you get into the harmonics come later?
Yeah.
Ah.
Get it?
Little audio.
If you took the class, you'd get the joke.
Bobby.
It's fun, that is.
Yeah.
Are you working on anything fun and exciting?
Yeah, I'm doing two little things. Got a little a CD going, a trio, actually a quartet, jazz quartet, going to cut it at my bud's place. And just got my Trailer Trash Library just got signed by Five Alarm. So,
great.
Yeah, so
kind of
good.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
And Martin. We're close, aren't we?
It is close. It is close. And we're at that point now where, you know, heading towards Christmas, and we're thinking, do we release right before Christmas or do we release just after? And the website's nearly finished. So we're coming to that sort of crux of the pulling it all together at the right time and making. We want to get some magazines involved. And so you've got to do lead lines and give them enough time to do that. So, but I couldn't be more close. In fact, this week, I'm picking up the CD Bobby's going to be helping me put it into, I think it's Gracenote, isn't
Gracenote,
it?
Yeah.
So that people can see it on their cars. And things. Actually, Bobby helped me a great deal with mastering this and getting it technically right at the mastering, and it does sound pretty wonderful due to his help. So,
didn't do a bloody thing, actually.
Can I ask a little question? Because, Martin, you mentioned something that's really interesting, the way the music industry works today. Have you been able to figure out, with the level playing field of marketing your own music, whether release times like before Christmas and after Christmas actually affect selling your own product the way it used to affect the majors?
Good question. This is for me, because it's an independent thing. It's a bit what we were talking about before. When it's ready, it's ready.
It shouldn't matter as much.
Not at all to me. You know, the only thing is what we're thinking about is we'd like to have a few people on board that we'd like, you know, to be to do the interviews at the right time and to have a little bit of coordination so everything's sort of moving around at the same point. So,
and is it harder to do that around the holidays or?
It's not. It's about really getting, you know, everything coming in at just at the right time, and we're we've got people that are interested in doing the interviews and whatever. So, but they're all at different times. So we're just trying to get a feeling about when most of it is going to look good for us. That's, we're just, and it's not like, hey, we've got to get this out for Christmas because it's a Christmas seller, or we have to get it out in next year for Valentine's Day or something.
So it's not the way the labels used to think about.
Well, I think it could be for labels, because, you know, when you've got an artist who's going to, you know, explode through Christmas, it's a good time to get it out. But for independent music, just like we were talking about with Radiohead, for me personally, it's when all the ducks are in line and you feel like this feels pretty good. And you can't get everything done at the same, at the right time. But for me, it's like, well, everything seems to be in a nice place. The website's ready. The mastering's been done. We've got, you know, a couple of magazines that want to talk about us, and the website is ready to go. So it's always goes a little slower than you would hope. I, you know, I was hoping for September, but we're very near, but all the ducks aren't quite in line.
Gotcha.
All right. Well, hey, guys, it was a great show, and thank you very much for listening. And once again, if you wanted to send us an email or get in touch with us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also visit us on our MySpace page and post a comment. And that's myspace.com/audionowcast. All right. Well, thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
But we want to wish your dad
the very best.
Yes, the very best. Recover soon.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.